This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. In 1970, the richest Americans paid more than 50% of their income in taxes. Today, following the Republican tax cuts, billionaires pay about 23% of their income in taxes. This is less than steelworkers, school teachers, and retirees. As billionaires in the United States continue to get richer, many Americans are seeing their paychecks vanish. How have billionaires managed to pay less through tax avoidance and loopholes? In his new book, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay, today's guest, Gabriel Zucman, writes, "The most fundamental reason to oppose America's current tax regime is the inequality spiral that it feeds. As we've seen, the income share of the top 1% has ballooned, while that of the working class has collapsed. And yet, instead of tamping it down, the tax system has reinforced this trend. The wealthy used to pay a lot, they now pay less. The poor used to pay relatively little, their duties have increased. In 2018, for the first time in the last 100 years, the top 400 richest Americans have paid lower tax rates than the working class." Gabriel Zucman is professor of economics at UC Berkeley. He's the author of three books, including The Hidden Wealth of Nations, where he conducted research into tax havens. He found that 8% of the world's household financial wealth is held in tax havens. His latest book is The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. Along with the book, he and his colleagues created the website taxjusticenow.org, which we will talk about during the show. And Gabriel Zucman joins us from UC Berkeley's Journalism School studio. Hi, Professor Zucman. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for writing this important book. And I want to start off by talking about how you begin. You have a story in here about the debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And this was in September 2016. And Clinton baited Trump into talking about how little he paid over the years. She said the only tax returns that anybody's seen was when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. And he proudly admitted to it, saying, quote, "That makes me smart." Professor Zucman, why did you decide to start your book with this story?
It's a striking story because it illustrates a number of things. One is that you have a number of extremely wealthy people, and Trump is one example, who indeed pay very little in taxes or almost nothing. The second is that this has become so accepted that Trump could go on TV and brag about that, which is a dramatic departure compared to several decades ago when dodging taxes was seen as extremely bad, as not socially accepted. Now, today, it's much more socially accepted, at least in some circles. And the third reason is, you know, in the debate, Clinton didn't have a good answer to this. She had in her platform a number of, if you want, technocratic fixes for the tax system, plugging loopholes and so on, but no kind of big picture radical plan to address tax injustice and to make sure that the wealthy pay a lot in taxes. And so what we've tried to do in the book is we wanted to understand how the U.S. came to that point, how arrived at a situation when extremely wealthy individuals, not all of them, but some of them, pay little in taxes, and this is accepted. And at the same time, a situation where there was, at least until recently, no clear answer that was offered by neither, you know, the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party to that problem.
You write that Trump's boast revealed a failure of American society. It had become so natural that the affluent do not contribute to the public coffers that a candidate for the presidency would openly admit to it while his opponent offered no clear solution in response. And now, Professor Zucman, you're a French economist, right?
Right.
And so I just wonder, I took a trip to Europe recently, and it was so fascinating to talk with Europeans from everywhere, from the Czech Republic to Italy to France to Germany to Denmark, about their healthcare system. None of them go bankrupt when they get sick. None of them go into debt when they go to school. And so we talked about those major changes. The other question I had for them is, how much do the wealthy, or do you, pay in taxes? Almost everyone very casually said about 40-45%. And so as someone who's from a different country that pays higher taxes, what are your thoughts about what is happening here in the U.S. that someone like Trump, it's like so many others, would brag about not paying taxes?
What strikes me is the U.S. used to have a very progressive tax system. It's not only a European thing, far from it. In fact, some of the key progressive fiscal institutions have been invented by the U.S. From the 1930s to the late 1970s, the top marginal income tax rate in the United States averaged about 80%. The top estate tax rate was close to 80% as well. There's no continental European country that ever had such high tax rates on the very rich and on the highest income earners. This is a U.S. invention. This is a U.S. tradition. What we're trying to do in the book is to help the American public reconnect with this progressive tax tradition that's played such an important role in U.S. history. You know, look, for instance, one story we tell, which I find very striking, is this famous speech that Franklin Roosevelt gave in Congress in 1943. He goes to Congress and he says, look, I think that nobody should have an income after paying taxes of more than $25,000. At the time, you know, that's the equivalent of several millions of today's dollars. And therefore, I propose a 100% top marginal income tax rate on income above $25,000. Congress hesitates a little bit. They find that 100% maybe is a bit too much. And they agree on 93%, which is not so far from 100%. And then in the decades that followed, you know, all the way to the early 1980s, the top marginal income tax rate was 90%, and still, you know, 70% when Reagan entered the White House in 1981. And again, the important point is this is something that's, in fact, uniquely American. There was never such a thing in France or in Germany or in Italy. You know, the only period of time when a continental European country had such high top marginal income tax rate, such a highly progressive tax system, was Germany between 1945 and 1948, when it was actually the United States that was deciding tax policy in Germany just after World War II. So that's the important point. You know, sometimes people have this feeling, this view that, oh, the U.S. is an anti-tax, a low-tax country, that people hate taxes, that they love small governments. And there is, for sure, a tradition of an anti-tax, anti-government, you know, anti-democratic tradition, but there is also a very strong pro-tax, very strong tax justice, tax progressivity tradition in America.
You write that in 1970, the richest Americans paid, all taxes included, more than 50% of their income in taxes, twice as much as working class individuals. Also in 1970, billionaires paid over double what they do in taxes today. So what else strikes you when you look at how much has really changed over the last 4 or 5 decades?
The most striking fact is the dramatic decline in the effective tax rates of the very wealthy. Because sometimes you hear people saying, yes, okay, it's true that on paper, the U.S. tax system looked progressive in the 50s, in the 60s, with this 90% top marginal income tax rates. But nobody paid these rates. That there's a widespread view that says, look, the U.S. tax system might have looked progressive on paper, but in actual facts, never was really progressive, and the rich really never paid a significant fraction of their income in taxes. And so we took that seriously, and we created statistics about the effective tax rate paid by each income group all the way back to 1913. And what we found and what we describe in the book is for several decades, from the 1930s to the 70s, the effective tax rate of the very rich was actually very high. When you take into account all taxes paid at all levels of government, so federal plus state plus local, top 0.1% wealthiest Americans paid 55-60% of their income in taxes in those mid-century decades. And today they only pay 30%. So their effective tax rate has been divided by two. If you look at the billionaires, the top 400 wealthiest Americans, the decline is even more dramatic. From effective tax rates of 70% in the early 1950s to just 23% last year in 2018, in the aftermath of the of President Trump's tax reform, and so the injustice that we emphasize in the book is that these extremely wealthy individuals saw their income and their wealth skyrocket, basically. We all know about the dramatic increase in income and wealth concentration. So their income and their wealth has grown much faster than income and wealth for the rest of the population. But the injustice is that as they grew wealthier, their tax rates, instead of increasing, have actually declined enormously, again from about 70% for the top 400 richest Americans in the 1950s to just 23% last year. And to fix ideas, 23%, the average tax rate in the U.S., if you take total tax revenue divided by total national income, is 28%. So on average, Americans pay 28% of their income in taxes. It turns out that almost all income groups, the working class, the middle class, you know, the upper middle class, pay around 28% of their income in taxes. And the main exception is the ultra-wealthy, the billionaires, who pay just 23%. So that's a striking development, and that's, in our view, a phenomenon that's not sustainable. Because you understand the problem. If the very rich face effective tax rates of just 23%, it means that their wealth is going to mechanically keep growing faster and faster as the wealth of the rest of the population. Wealth generates income, income that's saved at a high rate, income that's taxed at a low rate, and you have a snowballing effect where the wealthy, just by virtue of being rich, become wealthier. The tax system used to limit this snowballing effect and to prevent the rise of inequality. But now, with just 23% tax rates at the very top, there's no barrier anymore. And so the risk is the risk of seeing ever more wealth concentration in the future.
So today, billionaires in the United States pay less tax than teachers, for example. Today, we're speaking with Gabriel Zuckman, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, about his new book, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. Coming up after a break, we'll talk about how we got here and we'll talk about solutions. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're joined by Gabriel Zuckman, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, and he's out with an important new book, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. And if you have questions for Professor Zuckman, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We'll talk about how the United States went from having one of the most steeply progressive systems of taxation on the planet to where we are today, where billionaires are paying less than teachers. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Professor Zuckman, as you said, in the 1930s, the top marginal tax income tax rate was 90% on the highest earners. Corporate profits were taxed at 50%. Large estates were close to 80%. And with all of that revenue, the U.S. was able to build schools, fund public universities. I mean, there's just so many social services that this country was able to fund. When you did your research, when you looked at how we got here, what really stands out for you? Because the George W. Bush tax cuts, of course, got a lot of attention. The Republican Trump tax cuts got a lot of attention. But what else really stands out for you about how it's shifted so drastically?
What stands out is a specific process where first you have an outburst of tax avoidance, of tax dodging, that for a number of reasons is tolerated, sometimes encouraged by government. And it lasts a few years, and then you have governments saying, oh, look, the tax system is not working. It's become impossible to tax the rich or to tax big multinational companies, and therefore we should slash their rates. And that's the story behind two of the most important tax reforms of the last decades. One is the 1986 Tax Reform Act, which reduced the top marginal income tax rate from 70% when Reagan entered the White House in 1981 to 28% in just after 86. That's a fascinating change. That's the U.S. was the country with the highest top marginal income tax rate in the 70s, and then in 86 this rate is reduced to 28%, which at the time was the lowest rate among wealthy countries. And the way this happened is, of course, you have these big political and ideological changes in the early 80s with Reagan's victory. But you have more than that. You have in the 5-6 years before the Tax Reform Act of 1986 an explosion of tax dodging. When Reagan enters the White House and says, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. This worldview, this ideology, legitimizes tax dodging, tax avoidance. And you see this industry mushroom and create new tax avoidance products and market those products in newspapers, you know, like toothpaste. And you see the tax dodging rise, and then everybody, you know, becomes convinced that, oh, look, there's so much tax avoidance, the income tax is not working, we can't do anything, we just have to slash the rates and make up for the lost tax revenue by plugging loopholes. And that's how you get this 1986 Act, where 97 senators out of 100 actually vote for it, for this dramatic decline in top marginal income tax rates to 28%. And a similar story happened with the corporate tax. So in December 2017, the corporate tax rate was slashed from 35% to 21%. And although that time Democrats did not vote for this tax reform, many of them had become convinced that slashing the corporate income tax rate was the right thing to do because, see, there was so much tax avoidance, tax dodging by multinational companies, trillions of dollars in profits that were shifted to places like Bermuda, like the Cayman Islands or Ireland, taxed at very low rates. This idea that taxing big multinational companies in a globalized world had become impossible, this idea had become mainstream, and that's what paved the way, just like in 1986, that's what paved the way to the Trump tax cut. So that's what strikes me, and what we try to explain in the book is that, look, tax avoidance, tax evasion, tax competition, these are not laws of nature. Sometimes governments choose to tolerate or to encourage these things, and sometimes they choose the opposite, not to tolerate them. You see how the New Deal era tax system worked, and in the decades after the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt went on the radio to say how important it was to pay taxes, to attack tax dodgers, to blame them, and so on, upholding the norms and the belief system that makes a progressive tax system possible. And so the point is that if there is the political will to make taxes work, to make the tax system, a progressive tax system, work well in practice, that's something that's doable. These norms have changed a lot over time, but we may be at the beginning of a new U-turn. You know, the history of taxation in the U.S. is full of U-turns. There was the Reagan Revolution in the 1980s, and now maybe we're at the beginning of a new phase and a return to a more progressive tax system.
We have a question from Jake in San Francisco about tax havens. Hi, Jake. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Stick with me while I try and briefly explain my point of view and my question. Income tax and wealth tax are all fine ideas in theory. The problem is in practice, as we've seen throughout history. As you said, it's a political situation, and it has to do with laws, not nature. And people that are wealthy have always been very clever about being able to hide their wealth, so that even if there's tax schemes, they don't get touched. What I would suggest instead is that almost every person of great wealth has gotten that way through some government entity. In other words, Zuckerberg has gotten rich because the government developed the internet. People that have gotten rich through oil were given mineral rights. People that got rich through the land railroad were given land rights. Those are all government entities. So instead, I would suggest that a tax scheme that forces them to pay based on using things that the government and the people own or have developed is a much clearer way of being able to share the wealth that belongs to the people rather than the individuals.
Thank you. Professor Zuckman, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you. I think you're absolutely right that nobody builds a great fortune alone. All the big fortunes that exist—they exist because, you know, governments have made these possible. Because the wealthy were able to benefit from markets that exist because governments make these markets work. They were built these big fortunes thanks to workers that were trained teachers in public schools and so on. And these fortunes that benefited from public infrastructure that all of us, helped pay. And so you're absolutely right that this is the moral case for taxing, great fortunes, and in particular, in my view, and that's what we try to explain in the book, the most powerful way to ensure that the very wealthy contributes significantly to the public coffers is through a wealth tax, a tax on wealth itself. You can think, for instance, of the tax that was proposed by Senator Warren, 2% above $50 million, 3% above $1 billion. And to address your question, I'm less pessimistic than you are about the ability of governments to make taxes work. So you're saying, look, the wealthy always find ways to dodge taxation, to exploit loopholes and so on. And I think the reality is more nuanced than that. When you look again at how taxes worked from the 1930s to the 1970s, I'm not saying there was no tax dodging. There was some of it, but it was much more limited for the simple reason that governments did not tolerate or did not encourage it. And so they regulated the industry that helps the wealthy avoid taxes, and they upheld the norms that make progressive taxation work, you know, explaining to people why paying, and to rich people in particular, why paying taxes is important. And you see that in the numbers when you look at the effective tax rates that the wealthy paid in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. These effective tax rates were high, 50%, 60%. And it is, in my view, possible to return to something like that. The way the U.S. tax system achieved its big progressivity in the 50s, in the 60s, was essentially through the very high corporate income tax rates of 50%. For the 21st century, I think it's possible to do better. The corporate tax is too crude an instrument, just 50%, just a single tax rate. A wealth tax with wealth tax rates that increase with wealth is a more powerful tool to create progressivity and to make sure that the very wealthy pay higher tax rates than the rest of us.
Well, thank you for calling, Jake. Professor Zuckman, because you brought up Senator Warren, Senator Warren's team used some of your data to come up with her tax plan, which has been getting a lot of attention. It would apply to households making over $50 million, and she would impose a 2% tax on net worth above $50 million. So she always says it's that extra dollar over $50 million. And a 3% tax on net worth above $1 billion. And according to your numbers, if this went into effect, it would raise $2.75 trillion over the course of 10 years. And according to The New Yorker, who did a long profile of the work that you do, the entire revenue of the federal government in the current budget year is $3.4 trillion. So tell us about this Warren plan, and what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, to understand these revenue numbers, you have to realize how much wealth inequality there is today in the U.S. So there is simply a ton of wealth at the top of the wealth distribution. The top 0.1% richest households used to own about 7% of total U.S. wealth in 1980, and today they own about 20% of total U.S. wealth. That's about as much as what is owned by the bottom 90% of the distribution. So you have a tenth of a percent, the top 0.1%, that owns as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And so that's the reason why a wealth tax, if it was well enforced, if it was well designed, if it came with resources for the IRS to conduct audits. That's the reason why a wealth tax could generate a lot of revenue, simply because there's a lot of wealth at the top. In the Warren proposal, and Senator Sanders has also a wealth tax proposal with even higher tax rates on billionaires, these proposals come with more resources for the IRS, come with very serious guarantees in terms of how the tax would be implemented in practice, which makes me optimistic about the possibility to actually collect a lot of revenue on these very wealthy families. Just to illustrate how the wealth tax would change the situation compared to the current status quo. As I said, the top 400 richest Americans today, their effective tax rate, everything included, is 23%. With the Warren wealth tax, their effective tax rate would double to 46%. With the Sanders wealth tax, their effective tax rate would increase to more than 70%, about as high as in 1950. So just a tax at a few percent for the ultra wealthy on the stock of wealth rather than just an income has the potential to make the tax system dramatically more progressive, to collect a lot of revenue. And these are revenues that could be used for healthcare, for education, for childcare, for student debt relief, and for things that would benefit dozens of millions of Americans.
So Warren's proposal would bring in about $2.6 trillion and Bernie Sanders would bring in about $4.35 trillion over 10 years. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear next from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. As you may recall, when the tax cut was put, the Trump tax cut was enacted, it was enacted with an argument that it would decrease the deficits because there would be so much money in the economy from the cuts that the deficit would go away. As you know, the deficit is 30% higher than under Obama, and has now hit $1 trillion for this year. I would like the guest's perspective on at what point the amount of interest that's having to be paid on the deficit will collide with economic growth if the deficit keeps increasing due to the tax cut.
Thank you.
Thanks, William. That's a very important question, and you're absolutely correct to point out that the notion that tax cuts pay for themselves is completely wrong. We see a striking illustration with the Trump tax reform that slashed tax rates on corporations and on the very wealthy with lower estate tax rates and lower top income tax rates. And what do we see? We see a big decline in tax revenue and a big increase in the deficit. Right now, we are in an environment where interest rates on government debt are low, and they might stay low for a number of years. Nobody really knows. But you are correct that at some point they might increase, and the interest burden might become significant, and that's why you want to protect yourself against that risk, which means at some point it's going to become necessary to reduce the deficit. Now, what's the best way to do that? You know, one good way to do that is maybe by taxing the wealthy more, collecting more revenue and spending on things like childcare, like education, like health, which are going to make the rest of us more productive and the economy grow, in turn generating more tax revenues and contributing to reduce the deficit. So I would say that's probably the best strategy in the medium run. You know, investing in the infrastructure, in education, in health, in all these things that make countries prosperous and communities wealthy. That's probably the best way, ultimately, to control the deficit and the debt.
Thank you for the question, William. Professor Zechman, we only have about a minute left. I'd love to have you back because we have so many more callers and emails. How do we shift the conversation around taxes? Carolyn writes, how can we educate the public about changes that are really affecting them in a negative way? I mean, you have a lot of Democrats who don't really talk about taxes in a constructive way. So how do we shift the conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we're trying to shift the conversation with the website that we developed, taxjusticenow.org, where everybody can easily see how much taxes each group of the population pays today and how this would change with simple reforms. So any user can, for instance, create a wealth tax, change the wealth tax rate, or change the corporate tax rate, or make the income tax more progressive. And the website shows two things. One is the immediate effect on tax progressivity, how the effective tax rates of each group of the population would change. And the other is the effect on tax revenue, how much resources would be generated. I think with this type of tool, we can contribute to make the tax debate more democratic, to have a more informed democratic deliberation about taxes, and ultimately contribute to shifting the conversation.
Gabriel Zechman is professor of economics at UC Berkeley, and his latest book is The Triumph of Injustice: How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. Professor Zechman, thank you so much for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.